I was a student and on my own in a new city. Money was always a worry, but I managed to find some ways to make a bit extra. The ones that stand out were a session I did as a life model. I was very embarrassed throughout, and I hope anyone painting my face had a good supply of red paint because I was blushing a lot. One afternoon, I gave a DNA sample at a medical facility as part of a research program. This took hours because I also had to fill in a detailed questionnaire about my family medical history, get blood tests and be weighed and measured. They even photographed me. Talk about thorough. Then there was a time I agreed to have a fake tattoo on my forehead to advertise a new clothes shop that had just opened. Their brand was trendy and daring, and the tattoo looked so real I got gawped at a lot as I walked up and down the street. I even got my picture on a news website. The people that ran the shop were delighted, and so was I when they paid me twice what we agreed on, cash in hand. The fact the fake tattoo took 2 weeks of me washing my face 4 times a day to come off was not a problem. My course was difficult, but I was up for a challenge. My apartment was small and had a rodent infestation problem, possibly. I could hear something scurrying around in the cavities at night, and rodents were the least disturbing thing I could think of. So, all in all, I was living my life. Until I saw him, standing in the street outside my window. I'd had a very busy few months, so much so that I hadn't even had time to earn any extra money. There were exams looming, and I'd had a romance with a girl I really liked. I was actually feeling pretty down because she left town, and it looked like that was the end of our relationship. So I was feeling distracted that day, and had to do a double take to check I wasn't seeing things. I moved closer to the glass and squinted, said, "Wow," under my breath. The man standing in the street outside my window looked exactly like me. The same almost black and unruly hair, a nose that's one size too big for the face it's on, a clear complexion and brown eyes that were staring back at me. It was the weirdest feeling. I suppose with the billions of people in the world, the odds of some of us having total lookalikes were not beyond possible. But that was my double out there, and from the way they were acting, they wanted to meet me. I had to find out what the hell was going on, so I opened the window, leaned out and shouted, "Fourth floor, second left buzzer." My double nodded and disappeared from view. Moments later, I was hearing the clang on the main door opening as I let him in. My apartment was a tip. There was weak old pizza crust on the floor, empty soda bottles everywhere, junk mail and mail I really shouldn't have been ignoring in a growing pile in the hall. My bed was a whirlpool of clothes, books, bedding, and yet more pizza remains. If my double is anything like me, he won't mind, I thought, then laughed at the strangeness of the situation. The buzzer to my apartment door went. I took a deep breath and went to let him in. The first thing I noticed as I asked him to come in and sit down, and while I was sweeping the worst of the debris off the sofa, was that he really didn't look well. He was kind of pale and had a sheen of sweat. His eyes were bloodshot, and he had the shakes. Seeing him up close, though, also confirmed my initial impressions. This guy was identical to me, down to the same gap in between his top two teeth. But not quite the same voice. His accent was different. It was kind of bland. I noticed this when he said, "I'm so sorry." Which was a pretty odd way to start a conversation with a complete stranger, no matter how much he looked like them. "About what?" I asked. I'm from the south and still have quite the twang. And when I said this, I saw from his expression that my accent was food for thought for him as well. He rubbed his face instead of answering my question. I figured he was exhausted or maybe stressed. Both would explain his pallor. Or perhaps he had some kind of bug. "Could I have a glass of water? He asked. Sure, I said, and went in search of the nearest thing I had to a clean glass. Now he was in my apartment. The first twinges of unease were creeping in. On the one hand, he did look like me. On the other, he was also a complete stranger, was acting weird, was possibly infectious or not in his right mind. And now, he was crying. Hey, I said, handing him the glass of water. What's wrong? He took a sip, eventually. His hands were shaking so bad, the surface of the water was seriously choppy, and said, I escaped. I had to. I couldn't stand it anymore. All the tests, the uncertainty. It was too much. This came pouring out of him. Then he properly broke down, and his tears were now sobs that racked his entire body. Damn, I thought. What had I done inviting him in? I felt sorry for him, I really did. But clearly, he had problems that needed professional help. My worry shot up a bunch more levels when he reached out and grabbed my hand. You're the only person I could turn to, he told me with a manic edge to his voice. I saw you this morning, by chance, I guess, by freak accident, and I followed you here because I knew that you were the one, that they made me from you. A cold chill ran down my spine. I pulled my hand free. Whoa, dude, I said. I don't know what you're talking about. I asked you up here because I was intrigued by our resemblance. Who wouldn't be? But I'd like you to leave now. I was trying to be reasonable, to hope he would respond well to being treated this way. But he didn't. He started to shake his head and mutter, no, 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 under his breath. I began to consider calling 911. Then he looked me straight in the eye and said, I need you to believe me. He turned and looked at my laptop, which was balanced precariously on the edge of my garbage-tipped bed. Go online and look up Futures We Believe MedTech Facility. They are the people responsible. As much to humor him as anything else, that's what I did. The minute he said the name, it sounded familiar, but it wasn't till I was on their corporate website that I realized why. This was the medical facility where I'd given a sample of my DNA for money a few months before. I was clicking through into various pages on the website to give myself time to think what to do about my now unwanted guest. When I saw someone on their Our Staff page, I recognized. Her name was Mary, and she'd been friends with my girlfriend. My ex-girlfriend, I thought with a sigh. I'd only met Mary a couple of times, but she'd seemed nice, and I now recalled her talking about applying for jobs once she finished her PhD. I glanced back at my double. He had his head in his hands and was looking through his fingers at me. He didn't look dangerous at that moment in time. Just lost. Badly in need of a friend. For better or worse, I decided I would try and help him. I'm going to contact someone I know, I said. They might be able to shed some light on things. Then I tracked down Mary on social media and DM'd her. Hey, it's Matt here, Joseph's friend. I'm researching a paper on the social implications of genetic research and saw you got a cool new job. Wondering if you could spare 5. The coffee's on me. I didn't like to lie, but if I told her the truth, she'd most likely block me, and I wouldn't blame her. Still, I wasn't holding up much hope of an answer, and I was wondering if I should wake up my double, who had curled up on the sofa and gone to sleep, when my notification showed I had a new message. What do you know? Mary had got back to me. Hi Matt, good to hear from you. I'm sorry about you and Josie. I don't know if I can be any help, but I'm always up for a free drink. I replied straight away, suggesting we meet at a cafe I found online that was close to where she worked. I showered and found my least smelly clothes and was ready to set off. My double was still fast asleep. I thought about waking him and telling him he needed to leave as I was going out, then decided against it. Maybe a good sleep would help him. And let's face it, apart from my laptop, I had nothing worth stealing. I popped the laptop in a backpack and let myself out quietly. It took me about 30 minutes to walk to the cafe, and by the time I arrived, Mary was already there. She was sat at a corner table. I smiled and waved and went over to say hi. "Hey," she replied. She seemed jumpy, her fingers constantly tapping on the table, and she kept looking over at the door. "Is everything okay?" I asked. "Sure, yeah," she replied. She didn't say this with any conviction, and I could see she'd bitten her fingernails right down. "It's just," she continued, then paused because someone had walked into the cafe and she was checking them out. "Are you expecting someone?" I asked. She sighed. "Sorry, work is difficult at the moment." "I'm sorry to hear that," I said. And, sighing to myself, I added, "I'm also sorry that I lied to you about why I wanted to meet." She clearly had a lot on her mind, and I couldn't keep pretending I was writing a paper. It would have just been plain wrong. Her fingers stopped tapping, and she exclaimed, "What?" I took a deep breath and told her everything about my encounter with my double. She grew increasingly pale as I spoke, and when I had finished, she asked, "Have you ever given a DNA sample?" I nodded. "A few months ago, at the facility where you work, it was an easy way to make money." She swore, then leaned forwards and said in a quiet voice, "You must keep this to yourself. The people I'm working for are creating clones, human clones. I have no in-person interactions with the clones, but it sounds like that's who you met." "My clone?" I said incredulously and far too loud. I lowered my voice and added, "That's crazy and completely illegal, surely." "It is," she replied. "All the work is taking place below the line, with absolute deniability built in. Not just because it's unethical and against the law to clone another person, with or without their permission, but also because the methods they are employing are incredibly dangerous. They are using experimental drugs that cause the cells to multiply at a tremendous rate. That's how your clone reached its adult form in the space of just a few months and..." She suddenly stopped and was looking over my shoulder. I glanced around. Two middle-aged men had come into the cafe. Both wore plain business suits and they were looking at us. "Who are they?" I asked Mary. She was looking down into a coffee, almost as if somehow this would mean the men couldn't see her. Whoever they were, she was clearly scared of them. Still staring at a drink, she said, "Facility security, you should leave. I'll message if I can." I figured it was best to do as she said and got to my feet. My legs felt unsteady as I headed out back onto the street. My encounter with my double had already left me feeling very unsettled. My conversation with Mary had further thrown me, leaving me shocked and confused. Feeling like my nerves had been in a cocktail shaker, I made my way back to my apartment. My double, my clone, was still there. Was still laid out on the sofa, and he was in a very bad way. He was coated in sweat and seemed to be delirious. He was trying to say something, but I couldn't hear what, so I leaned in close. He was saying, "It hurts," over and over again. Our faces were almost touching. I could feel his breath on my face. I was transfixed. This man was more than a double. He was a being that shared my DNA. We were built from the same blocks. And now I knew this, it felt like I was looking in a mirror. That I saw myself die. Saw my eyelids grow still, my breath cease, my body stop moving. I cursed, snapped myself out of my daze. Felt for his pulse, but there was nothing. I turned my mobile to camera and held the screen, almost touching his lips. It didn't fog. My thoughts began to race. I knew I had to call the emergency services and report this, but I first needed to throw up. I returned from the bathroom a few minutes later to yet another shock. My clone was moving again. His eyelids were flickering rapidly. His arms and legs jerked. It was as if he was having some kind of seizure. "Man," I said, "you gave me a serious fright there. I thought you were dead. I'm going to phone an ambulance for you." As I was keying in 911, a new message appeared from Mary. "They know where you live. You need to get out of there, now." "What the hell?" I said, and called her. She answered on the first ring. "Matt, I can't talk for long. I think they're following me." "Who are?" I asked. "Facility security," she replied. "I didn't go back to work. I needed time to think, so I went to the park instead. I'm sure I've just seen them." "You should phone the police," I told her. "They wouldn't believe me, and even if they did investigate, the facility would cover up the truth." "About the clones?" I cut in. "It's more than just about the clones." She sounded breathless when she said this, as if she was walking quicker and quicker. "It's about a problem that is caused by the rapid multiplication of the cells. This is killing the clones, but the drugs then keep acting after death, multiplying cells at obscene speed, and the clones are reanimated. They become zombies." Before she could say more, the call ended. I looked at the icon, my mind reeling at what she had told me. Then I became aware that my clone was getting to his feet, was standing there, swaying slightly, as if he was trying to remember how to walk, how to talk. I don't feel right," he said in a halting voice. "Because you're dead," I thought. And then someone kicked the door in. Two men burst into the apartment. They wore the same plain business suits as the men in the cafe, but I'd never seen them before. One of them pulled out a gun. "You need to come with us," he said. "No," I yelled at him. "We know what you're doing." The unarmed man smiled. "It's not we anymore," he said. "It's just you now. The one problem left. The one problem that can be easily eliminated." "What have you done to Mary?" I shouted. The armed man answered by pointing the gun at my head. "Guess," he said. Fear flooded my body. "No," I begged. "Please, don't." "It's too late," he told me. Suddenly, his partner screamed. It was a primal cry of pain that filled the apartment. I tore my gaze away from the barrel of the gun pointing at me and saw that the unarmed man was being torn apart. His head was almost severed and blood was spouting from the jagged wound that ran down the length of his neck. My clone held him by the scalp and was pulling. The head lifted, trailing a crimson slick spinal cord, and finally was separated. The man's mouth was still open, his eyes staring, but unlike my clone, I did not think there was any way back for him. He was dead meat. The man with the gun opened fire. Six bullets ripped through my clone's body. He looked down at the wounds as if they were nothing more than smoldering kisses, then threw himself at the man. He clamped his jaws down on the base of the man's neck and ripped out a chunk of flesh. The man howled with pain, then his legs gave way as he crumpled to the ground. My clone spat out the bloodied slab and fell on the man, began to devour him. I became a fugitive after this, from the facility. I spent all my money on a rundown car and kept driving, heading out into the desert. My clone was with me, cloaked in a blanket so no one could see him. He had barely spoken since slaughtering the men and saving my life in the process. I couldn't leave him behind after that. The man who was made from me. The zombie. I didn't believe I was in danger from him because of our genetic link. He had, though, continued to deteriorate. necrotic wounds had started to appear all over his flesh, and the sickly sweet scent of decay drifted from him. He said little and stared morosely out the window at the desolate landscape. I had recorded an account of what had happened on my phone. One day, somehow, I would hold the facility to account for what they had done. I was trying to think of how, when, next to me, the zombie started to cry. It was not the first time since we fled. I had no words of comfort, and silence soon returned. Until the zombie said, "Stop the car." "What, here?" I asked. "Yes." He sounded insistent, so I pulled over. There were no other cars in sight, no buildings. We were hundreds of miles from anything. Slowly, clearly hurting, the zombie got out of the car. I peered through the open door, asked, "What are you doing?"
"You need to leave me here," the zombie replied. "My thoughts are clouding over, worse and worse. And soon I won't recognize you anymore. Then the hunger will come."
"I can't just leave you here," I protested. The zombie looked at me.
"You're not," it said. "You're going to end me."
When we fled the apartment, I'd instinctively grabbed the gun the man had dropped when he was attacked. I'd hidden it under my car seat when we set off. I had no intention of using it. I was appalled, sickened, terrified by what was being asked of me.
"I'm not going to do that," I said. "You're me." "Not now," the zombie said sadly. "Not anymore."
He spoke to me quietly as we walked away from the car, as together we dug a grave for him. He told me that, of everything he could remember, the only time he had not felt scared and alone was as he had been falling asleep on the sofa in my apartment. The sound of the gunshot that followed still echoes in my mind.